Welcome to IP Management Voice, the podcast spotlighting leading minds in IP and IP management. This series supports the IP Business Academy's call for subject matter experts to share insights, foster reflection, and strengthen the global IP system. Join the conversation via our newsletter and explore cutting-edge content on D-Plex. The content featured in this episode on tax, compliance, and global regulation issues in IP licensing comes from Andreas Jakob.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. We spend so much energy perfecting the product, the technology, or, you know, the brand, the intellectual property itself. But the truth is, the IP's value, well, it's ultimately determined by a piece of paper, the licensing contract. It's the definitive blueprint that decides whether your brilliant idea translates into sustainable global profit, or if it simply leads to confusion and really catastrophic disputes.
That's absolutely right. And for you, our listener, our mission today is to really uncover the precise components needed to build agreements that truly safeguard that value. We're going on a deep dive into, well, legal precision, critical risk allocation, and surprisingly, the complex, often sort of invisible world of global compliance, particularly tax and antitrust. That whole landscape surrounds IP flow.
Okay, so we've distilled core insights covering contract foundations, the critical distinction between external and internal strategy, and importantly, how to navigate that global regulatory scrutiny. Let's unpack this, starting with the absolute basics,
yeah.
The four pillars that determine control in any external licensing partnership.
Yeah, when you look at the source material, every successful agreement starts by eliminating ambiguity, really nailing it down. If you don't define the four core foundation clauses with, let's say, surgical precision, you are essentially creating a gray zone. And that's a gray zone that lawyers will inevitably fight over down the road.
Okay, so what are those four key clauses?
First up, the grant clauses. What rights specifically are you licensing? Is it the patent, the trade secrets, the source code, maybe just the trademark? You have to be specific. Second, field of use, which strictly limits the industries or product categories where it can be used. Third is duration, setting the time limits, and crucially, the termination rights. How long does this deal last?
And the fourth one must be territory, right?
Yeah.
Defining the geography. They used to seem simple, North America, Europe. But with digital services and borderless commerce today, isn't defining territory much, much harder now?
Oh, it is much harder, yeah. The contract really needs to anticipate digital delivery. Is the territory defined by where the user receives the product, or maybe where the licensee is based? It's a key distinction. You absolutely must draft the clause to reflect the modern reality of digital consumption. Otherwise, your licensee might accidentally, or maybe not so accidentally, sell into a territory you reserve for yourself just by using a global server. Precision now saves you huge headaches later.
Makes sense. So once those fundamentals are set, the licensor faces this massive strategic choice. Exclusivity, the single decision immediately shapes market dynamics, incentives, risk, everything. We know exclusive and non-exclusive, but tell us a bit more about that spectrum.
An exclusive license is, well, it's powerful. It really motivates the licensee to invest heavily because they face zero competition from other licensees. Simple as that. That high incentive usually means the licensor can command higher royalties or maybe bigger upfront payments. The risk, however, and it's a big one, is that you are entirely dependent on that single licensee's performance. If they underperform, your IP value just stagnates globally. Big problem.
Right. So the licensor might then lean toward a non-exclusive license just to spread that risk out a bit. But doesn't using multiple licensees just guarantee constant quality control headaches or, worse, price wars between them?
It absolutely introduces that risk. You're spot on. Non-exclusive arrangements definitely broaden market coverage and reduce dependency on any one partner. But yeah, they demand rigorous management to prevent brand dilution or price erosion across different markets. You need really strict contractual quality gates baked right in.
And the hybrid solution. Is there a kind of best of both worlds option?
That's generally the sole license. This gives the licensee exclusivity against third parties, so no other outside company can get a license for that specific thing. But, and this is the important caveat, the original licensor retains the right to exploit the IP themselves in that same market. It's often used when the licensor wants to, say, maintain a direct presence in the market, but maybe delegate mass distribution or specific regional sales to the partner.
Okay, now here's where it gets really interesting, I think. The scope trap.
Mm-hmm.
Licensing is about granting rights today, sure, but innovation happens tomorrow, often really quickly.
Yeah.
How do you future-proof the rights without accidentally giving away the farm?
This is definitely a major source of litigation because parties inevitably disagree about the scope years down the line. It happens all the time. You must precisely define if the license covers only the existing IP or if it automatically extends to future improvements, you know, the next iteration of the patented widget, for instance. And crucially, does it cover derivative works? That's a big one.
Can you give us a quick example of how that could go wrong, like a disaster scenario?
Sure. Imagine you licensed the first generation of some proprietary software back in, say, 2015. It was for a specific hardware platform, but your agreement didn't explicitly cover fundamental future developments. Things like necessary integration for AI, which nobody saw coming quite like this, or maybe the jump to 5G capability. If that wasn't covered, you've unintentionally licensed the equivalent of a horse-drawn buggy in the age of jets. That lack of clarity essentially stifles the licensee's market potential and, honestly, destroys the long-term value of the partnership for both sides.
Wow, okay. That makes perfect sense. So let's shift gears slightly and look at defining the danger and allocating risk. The guiding principle here seems clear from the sources. Liability follows control.
That's the bedrock, absolutely. The party that controls an activity, whether it's manufacturing the product, defending the underlying patent against infringement claims, or, say, marketing the trademark, that party should bear the corresponding risks and liabilities. Misaligning control and liability is just inviting financial disaster later on.
Right. Now, I often hear the terms warranties and indemnities used almost interchangeably in agreements. People tend to blur them. What's the fundamental practical difference a company owner really needs to worry about? And why are both necessary?
Okay, good question. Think of warranties as the promises. They are the assurances from the licensor confirming foundational facts. Things like, yes, we actually own this IP. We definitely have the authority to license it. And critically, using this IP as we've permitted won't infringe on any third-party rights. These are the baseline guarantees.
Got it. So warranties are the promises. If those promises turn out to be broken, say, a third party sues the licensee claiming infringement, that's where the indemnity mechanism kicks in.
Exactly. Indemnities are the financial fallout protection. They dictate who pays for the losses, the damages awarded, the hefty legal fees, settlement costs. If an infringement claim arises because a warranty was, well, incorrect. Now, a smart licensor will almost always try to limit their financial exposure here, perhaps capping the total indemnity amount or excluding liability entirely if the licensee misuses the IP beyond the clearly defined scope.
Okay, we've been focused mainly externally so far on partners. But before we zoom out to the big picture of global compliance, we need to look inward for a moment. The jump from external indemnities to the need for internal licensing might seem a bit odd at first glance, but the source material calls this the hidden engine of value for multinational groups.
Hey, are you an IP expert with a focused topic you want to share? Then you might be just the right fit to become an IP subject matter expert at the IP Business Academy. It's a great opportunity to build visibility for your expertise and reach new clients through a trusted academic platform. You'll be supported in creating digital content, LinkedIn strategies, and outreach to your target group. If you're ready to raise your profile and position yourself as a thought leader, get in touch with us. We'd love to hear from you. End of advertisement.
If liability follows control externally, doesn't that same control principle apply inside the corporate walls too?
It absolutely does, and this is such an overlooked legal necessity. It really is. Internal licenses provide subsidiaries with the documented, formal legal right to use IP that's typically held by a central entity, maybe the parent company within the group. This ensures strategic alignment. Yes, that's part of it. But its primary function is actually compliance and risk reduction.
So what's the concrete threat? What happens if that internal licensing structure is missing, or maybe just sloppy and out of date?
The risk is enormous, particularly when you get into international trade. It's huge. If a subsidiary is manufacturing or selling products using group IP without a properly documented license, those products can be legally considered infringing in their local jurisdictions. This can lead to things like custom seizures, major barriers in import-export scenarios, and even legal claims from end users who might argue the product has some kind of latent legal defect. You basically undermine the very foundation of your global supply chain if you don't have this sorted.
Wow. So those internal contracts are essentially the defensive mechanism that protects global operations. And they also feed directly into the let's face it, complex and high-risk arena of international tax compliance, right?
Precisely. Licensing income, specifically those royalty payments flowing cross-border between related group entities, is arguably the single most scrutinized item by tax authorities globally. It's right at the top of their list. This entire framework operates under the arm's-length principle. Simply put, any intra-group royalty payment must be priced exactly as if it were negotiated between two completely independent, unrelated companies out in the open market.
But how on earth do companies calculate the value of something intangible, like proprietary know-how or a really complex patent portfolio, in a way that satisfies a skeptical tax auditor?
Mm-hmm.
That seems really subjective.
Well, they rely on specific, internationally recognized methods that aim to demonstrate that arm's length nature. The three major methods are often cited, but you're right, rarely explained simply. The first is the comparable uncontrolled price, CUP method. This is considered the gold standard. You basically look for a perfect market twin. What did we charge or what did someone else charge? A totally non-related third party for the exact same or highly similar IP license.
Okay, that sounds useful if you can find that perfect twin. But what if one just doesn't exist, which must be common for unique IP?
Exactly. Very often it doesn't. So then you have to look deeper into the overall profitability picture. You have the profit split method, which essentially divides the combined profits generated by the IP based on each entity's actual contribution, like who did the R&D, who's handling the complex manufacturing, who's doing the marketing effort. And then there's the transactional net margin method, TNMM. This one focuses on ensuring the licensee entity, the one paying the royalty, still retains a profit margin that is comparable to what other similar but not IP-owning companies in the same industry make.
That list of acronyms, CUP, TNMM, profit split, can feel a bit overwhelming for sure. What's a real consequence if the tax auditor comes in and believes you got the rate wrong? Too high or too low?
The consequences are severe, and they're driven heavily by international guidance known as BEPS. That stands for Base Erosion and Profit Shifting. It's a huge global initiative. If the royalty rate is deemed too high, the local tax authority in the licensee's country will likely disallow the deduction for that royalty payment. This means the income gets taxed once in the local subsidiary because they can't deduct it, and then it gets taxed again in the central IP holding entity when they receive it. That leads to painful double taxation, plus potentially large fines and interest penalties. You absolutely must ensure the royalty payment reflects the true economic substance of the transaction. Where is the value actually being created?
Okay, so beyond tax, licensing agreements operate within this really complex regulatory web. You mentioned antitrust earlier. What are the two primary compliance traps, besides tax, that can render an otherwise perfectly good contract completely unenforceable or illegal?
Right. First, as you said, antitrust and competition law. You simply cannot use a licensing agreement as a backdoor way to illegally restrict competition. Certain restrictive clauses, like telling your licensee the precise minimum price they must charge consumers, or dividing up territories between licensees in a way that creates clear monopolies, those are huge red flags for regulators. These agreements must comply with regional rules like the EU's TTBER, that's the Technology Transfer Block Exemption Regulation, which essentially sets out safe harbors for acceptable clauses versus problematic ones.
Got it. So the goal is fostering competition, or at least not actively colluding, even if it's hidden inside a contract.
Mm.
And the second major hurdle relates more to global security.
That's export control. And this is absolute and mandatory. There's very little wiggle room here. If your license involves transferring sensitive technologies, especially things related to defense, what they call dual use items, civilian and military applications, specialized cryptography, or maybe advanced manufacturing know-how across international borders, you must comply with strict national and international export control laws. Failure here isn't just about a penalty or a fine. It often leads to criminal liability for the individuals involved in the company. Very serious stuff.
Okay, so we've covered structure, risk allocation, internal needs, global compliance. Let's finish by focusing on strategy, specifically customization and future-proofing these deals.
Yeah.
What's the single biggest mistake people make in the drafting process itself?
Probably relying on a generic template, just pulling something off the shelf. It almost always fails because not all IP behaves the same way, not even close. The contractual focus, the key clauses, must be tailored precisely to the nature of the specific asset being licensed.
Can you give an example? How does that focus shift between different types of IP?
Sure. Take brand licensing, so trademarks. Here, the paramount concern, above all else really, is quality control. The contract absolutely must grant the licensor constant monitoring rights, approval procedures over product standards, packaging, marketing materials, everything. Why? Because poor usage by the licensee can rapidly dilute the licensor's hard-won brand value, or even, in extreme cases, lead to the loss of the trademark rights themselves. Now, contrast that with software licensing. The focus shifts dramatically. It's more about updates, maintenance schedules, usage restrictions, like how many users are allowed, on how many servers. And critically, especially now, you must ensure the contract properly addresses compliance regarding any underlying open source components embedded in the code. That's a huge hidden risk area.
Yeah, open source compliance, that's a massive, often overlooked risk.
Definitely.
Okay, finally, let's talk about multiplying market potential through sublicensing. It sounds great in theory, let your partner handle expanding reach. But if you allow your partner to license your IP further down the chain, how do you maintain financial control and transparency? How do you avoid losing track?
Sublicensing is often essential for maximizing market reach, especially globally. But if it's unmanaged, it's probably the quickest way to lose value and control. It really is. If you permit it, the main contract must strictly define what rights can be sublicensed and where. To whom? You also must set clear approval mechanisms so you have a say in who these sublicensees are. And most importantly, you need detailed revenue sharing arrangements clearly spelled out so you receive your proper cut of those downstream royalties from the sublicensees. And critically, you need audit rights that extend not just to your direct licensee, but throughout the entire sublicensing chain to prevent value leakage. You need to be able to follow the money.
Makes sense. And when it comes to the actual negotiation, sitting across the table, these deals are often built to survive for a decade or even more. What's the key strategic tool, maybe less legalistic, to use at the table to ensure you get the best possible deal for the long run?
Yeah, it's not really a legal term, it's a strategic one. Knowing your BATNA. That stands for your best alternative to a negotiated agreement. What's your plan B if this deal falls through? That knowledge provides you with essential, non-emotional leverage. It stops you from accepting unfavorable terms simply out of desperation or deal momentum. Successful negotiators, the really good ones, use creative structuring things like performance milestones that trigger higher royalties or tiered royalty rates based on volume to align the long-term interests of both parties rather than just clashing over a single fixed percentage on day one.
Right. So we've seen that building an effective, truly rock-solid IP license requires a genuinely collaborative, multidisciplinary approach. You need legal, financial, technical, and compliance expertise, all talking to each other and aligned. And compliance, far from being just a regulatory hurdle or a cost center, is actually a strategic mechanism for enabling and safeguarding the IP's global value over time.
Absolutely. And maybe a final thought for listeners, especially if you are part of a large, sophisticated company, the most proactive step you can take regarding governance is simply to ensure that your internal house is in order first. The simplest way to ensure strategic flexibility for future events like spin-offs, M&A activity, or major corporate restructuring is to maintain comprehensive, rigorous, and consistently up-to-date internal licensing agreements and documentation. That internal clarity protects you from yourself in many ways.
And that brings us right back to the tax point you made earlier and the core of that whole BEPS challenge facing multinationals. Given that regulators worldwide are increasingly challenging artificial tax structures, the ones that lack genuine economic substance, ask yourself this. Are your company's intellectual property flows and the resulting royalty payments crossing borders truly aligned with your actual business model? With the economic reality of where the value is genuinely being created? Or are you potentially operating with a hidden legal and financial risk that's just waiting for the next international tax audit to uncover it? That's the strategic question worth exploring right now.
Thanks for listening to IP Management Voice. If there's any topic you'd like us to cover in this podcast or on the content platform Dplex, please get in contact and let us know.